The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
Hey. I'm sitting here with Scott Stossel, who is the editor of The Atlantic Magazine and the author of the New York Times bestseller, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, and the award-winning Sarge, The Life and Times of Sergeant Shriver. Mr. Stossel's articles have appeared in a wide array of publications, including The New Yorker, The New Republic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Guardian. In 2014, Scott was awarded the Jed Foundation's Voices of Mental Health Award and the Eric Erickson Institute Prize for Excellence in Mental Health Media. In 2015, My Age was shortlisted for the Wellcome Trust Prize in the UK, and Scott won the Board of Directors Award from the Psychiatric Rehabilitation Association. In 2016, The Atlantic won the Magazine of the Year Award. That's cool, from the American Society of Magazine Editors. So thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, you took a plane here?
I did.
Can you talk about your preparation for the plane ride? If I imagine it hasn't changed since we talked about 3 years ago about this?
It has changed a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, there's a whole bunch of things I do that start, like, well in advance. Like, checking the weather.
Okay.
I have an app on my phone called Turbulence Advisory.
Okay.
I use that. You can start using that. It's actually not very accurate because I've had times where I'll enter it in and it'll say, oh, you know, the turbulence is going to be terrible, and then I, you know, over-prepare and then nothing happens. And there are other times where it says, oh, it's going to be turbulent and I'm terrified. Or it says it'll be smooth and that's going to end, and then, you know, all hell breaks loose. So I'll look at that, and that will actually do a lot to dictate how much I prepare. And then you know, the range of things that I do is depending on, you know, like Dramamine is a common thing, beta blockers, propranolol, or Inderol's trade name, which helps kind of block your sympathetic nervous system. I used to, until about a year ago, medicate very heavily with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Before every plane flight. In fact, it was a breakthrough moment. I remember when I would travel a fair amount for work, and I kept getting upgraded, and so I would, you know, eventually I achieved whatever status that I would be frequently flying first class, and I was flying on the same routes, and so they would just know I would get on the plane, and they would like give me two or three little bottles of scotch, so I would know I would be fine. And then sometimes if it was extra turbulent, I would, you know, and I'd have a few more. But I would only do that at night. And then I remember, actually, I was in Chicago, and it was this breakthrough moment when I was at the airport, and I was really nervous about getting on a plane. And I can't remember what the circumstances were. I mean, sometimes it's just my mood was anxious. Mm-hmm. I can't remember if I was nervous about it because the weather was going to be bad. And I remember sort of walking up to the, you know, bars where they would serve breakfast, and I was so embarrassed. I was like, I can't possibly order, you know, shots of vodka at 8 in the morning. But I look around, and like everyone, there's a whole bunch of people having beer, and then some people having a shot and a beer. So I kind of sit down, and I very nervously, you know, order my food, and I'm like, and I'll have, I said Cavalier. I was like, oh, is it too early for a drink? And she's like, no. And I was like, well, I'll have a Grey Goose on the rock. She goes, you want to make it a double?
what a gift.
And clearly, like, she sees this all the time. And for me, this was, like, what seemed at the time like a fabulous breakthrough.
Yeah.
Because suddenly I was like, oh, I can medicate for these flights, you know, all the time. the alcohol then sort of turned on me, and I became more and more dependent on it for more and more situations, and it was getting to the point where it was really problematic. So this new thing for me, I mean, so today, I mean, I have not drunk before flights.
Oh.
I will sometimes carry alcohol with me.
Just in case.
I did that today, but didn't drink. So anyway, I did fly today. I did my turbulence app thing. It seemed like it was going to be okay. I listened very attentively when, you know, as soon as the pilot comes on, you know, I'm trying to, and he said, well, we're going to be flying at 26,000 feet because that's where we hear the smooth air is going to be. And I'm like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Like, I want them to find the smooth air, but does that mean it's, anyway, it was really smooth. And actually, it was mostly fine today, except when we were coming in for a landing, they said we're coming in for a landing, and then suddenly there was just this noise. There's always the noise of the landing gear dropping, but it didn't sound right to me.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly it didn't sound right to a few other people, too, because people are sort of looking around, like it was, and for me, I'm like, you know, gripping the handrails, and I'm looking around immediately. And you know, my thing, like many people's, is immediately look at the flight attendants because, like, do they look scared?
Yeah.
And if they look okay and aren't like strapping themselves in a panic, I'm like, okay, we're probably not going to die yet. So anyway, I got here. It was fine.
On
time. It was fine. Yeah.
Yeah. When we first met, that was one of the first things, was describing the rituals that you went through, which were fascinating and exhausting in many ways. So that's a personal story, and we're going to talk about that because you talk about a lot in your book about that. But I also want to talk, because you did so much research on this topic, as a good journalist would do. And you write that anxiety is a consequence of modern life. And I want you to unpack a little bit about what that means to you and where you figured that out.
Well, partly I figured out just from my own lived experience of kind of going through the modern world and being overwhelmed by, you know, what they call the paradox of choice. Just that mm-hmm. there's so many options, from everything as banal as you go to the grocery store and there's 200 brands of breakfast cereal, and you know, I'm somebody. Who I realize, like, every, actually, there's another thing. When I get, and I don't know if this is anxiety or ADD, but like, I can't pack. Like, you know, when I'm trying to pack for a trip, my anxiety over, well, why this pair of underwear as opposed to this pair of underwear? And mm-hmm. I need two pairs or three pairs? And do I need these? And then I just get like overwhelmed, and I just want to sit down and cry. Like, so going into a grocery store and you're confronted with like 200 brands of, you know, breakfast cereal, it's sort of the same thing in a more minor way. The more significant thing, though, is just that, and this is really where it is a symptom of modern culture. I guess to back up for a little bit, we were talking earlier, mm-hmm. you know, anxiety is a hardwired, evolutionarily programmed emotion that is adaptive and helps to keep us alive. It is deeply, woven into our limbic system and our nervous system, and we are supposed to have powerful physiological and emotional reactions to things in the world, and the way, because it will direct us to react in certain ways that keep us safe. And that is a brute biological thing, and it's, so, you know, if you are confronted in the state of nature with a saber-toothed tiger, you will, you know, have a fight or flight reaction and be able mm-hmm. to run away. In the modern world, overlaid on top of that are all kinds of other anxieties that are sort of more existential. I mean, animals have fight or flight reactions. Are they anxious? Well, they're definitely fearful. They're definitely having the same physiological reaction, but they're not necessarily worried about, like, choosing breakfast cereals or about, like, what they should do for a living or whether they should get married or whether they should mm-hmm. have that baby or whether they should freeze their eggs. Like, all of these decisions that kind of get piled on that are, like, part of being human. And what's different about modernity, and by that I mean, you know, really, like industrial capitalism, but like everything since the Middle Ages, is that, you know, for a long period of time, you know, in agrarian societies, when you were growing up in tribes, you were, your role was, you didn't have a lot of decisions to make
mm-hmm.
That were hugely existentially significant. You were born into your tribe. Your role was fairly circumscribed. Everything was very ritualized. Your community was very clear. You may have had enemies, but the enemies were completely clear, and your group was your group, and your out group, and everything was just, there wasn't a lot of ambiguity. And then, you know, even when you start to have cities and people moving in to during the Middle Ages, still, you know, in feudal society, everything was strictly ranked ordered. And if you were born a peasant, that is what you were going to be for the rest of your life, and you were probably going to do what your father or mother had done. Mm-hmm. If you were born a vassal, you were going to do that. If you're born a priest, you know. there wasn't a lot of, like, I have to make these decisions and it's going to have these huge consequences for now. And, you know, arguably this is a good thing. You know, these are all consequences of political freedom. But you can choose, you know, what city to live in, who you want to marry, not just someone from your caste, class, or tribe. Where do you want to go to school? What do you want to do for a living? What do you want your sexual identity to be? What do you want your gender identity to be? That's a lot of things to have to be thinking about that are kind of overlaid. And then you've got the kind of capitalist overlay on top of this, which is just like giving you tons and tons of choices. And again, there's this retired psychologist from Swarthmore, Barry Schwartz, who called it something called the paradox of choice, that, you know, we're conditioned to believe that the more choice you have, the better, because of course you want an abundance of options. The reality is it can make you very, very, very anxious. Like, if I can't even decide how to pack in the morning, how am I going to decide how to get through the grocery store?
So the world we live in now, and you have some data that you write about in the book that, quote, anxiety and its associated disorders represent the most common form of officially classified mental illness in the United States today, more common even than depression and other mood disorders. One in four people that we know have anxiety, but that number has to be much higher because the people who don't mention it.
Right.
And that the average high school kid today has the same level of anxiety as the average psychiatric patient in the 1950s.
Yeah, and I mean that, and those, some people dispute those findings, but they're pretty striking. And you know, there are a lot of reasons why that might be, in particular, if you're with the high school kids, just because of helicopter parenting has kind of, I mean, the theory there is that, you know, you have your, there's tons of pressure, as we've seen with this college admission scandal, to like achieve. And, you know, and for good reason, because the way the economy is structured, you kind of like succeed a lot or you fail. That's oversimplification, but that's what it feels like. So therefore, you know, you're under all this pressure. And then you've got these helicopter parents who, again, out of well-meaning love and concern, are doing everything for you, which sort of robs you of a sense of agency, which
resilience.
Just makes you more, robs your agency, which makes, you know, these kids more anxious. So they're just, you know, they feel like there's these huge mortal stakes about getting into college or whatever. And their parents have done everything for them and tried to, you know, smooth the path. And suddenly they're out in the world and don't know how to do anything on their own. On the question of depression versus anxiety, I mean, this was true a little bit when I wrote the book, but in the, you know, 5 years since then, you know, there's more and more researchers who actually question whether there is a clear demarcation between anxiety and depression, or, you know, or if there are demarcations, are they in the right place? You know, there, you know, so I've been diagnosed in my life with, you know, generalized anxiety disorder, panic disorder, simple phobia, social anxiety, which again, I have, you know, there are reasons to believe those are real disorders that do exist that can be tested for. But if you take generalized anxiety disorder, which is basically the propensity to just worry excessively about lots of things all the time, that overlaps an enormous amount, both in terms of, like, if you give people a questionnaire, or if you look at people's brains in a brain scan, or if you test their genes, that overlaps a lot with certain forms of major depression, or what they used to call neurotic depression. So is generalized anxiety disorder, you know, because people who are depressed tend to have trouble, they tend to worry about a lot of things. If you worry a lot about things, you tend to be depressed, you know. And then there's lots of overlap in terms of what the neurochemical systems that underlie these different disorders are, and they're, you know, they seem to be similar. I mean, this is controversial now too. You know, for a long time it was the serotonin hypothesis. You know, this is the drug that's in Prozac and Paxil and Lexapro and things like that. And these drugs have some efficacy and they affect your serotonin system. But is that really why they're having an effect, or is that just an incidental effect that actually there's some other effect that's happening? But my point is, all of these things, anxiety, depression, you know, going back 50 years, psychiatrists, you know, going back to Freud, used to sort of view them on a spectrum that and it was all this mix of like neurosis or melancholy. And then we sort of tease them out and carve them up into these little discrete things that can be tested and measured. It's no longer so clear that they're really so distinct. Right. So if you're, you know, nervous and unhappy, depressed and anxious, are you depressed or are you anxious?
Right.
That's, it depends on, you know, who you ask. And many times the treatments aren't the same.
Right. But I think But the reality is still true, which is maybe if we're just seeing it now, we're seeing it in a different way. I mean, my daughter is at Lurie Hospital right now, and they just got a $15 million grant for a child psychiatry program because there's just not enough people available. Yeah. And then you talk to the palliative care team or the nurses and even some of the surgeons, which is this idea of treating the whole child, of understanding that there are conditions which are completely understandable, but used to not be treated unless you had like an amazing mm-hmm. team. And that's becoming far more commonplace.
Yep.
So this started for you as a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So talk about how that, what happened in your childhood? When did you figure this out?
Well, yeah, what do you mean by figure it out? But I mean, from a very young age, I was just a very anxious kid, sort of high reactive. I was extremely shy, would like cling to my mother, you know, like she couldn't, when she tried to leave me at nursery school, like I would basically like not let go of her mm-hmm. leg, which again is not uncommon, but it often is, it's you know, the kids who have that kind of, you know, distressed attachment temperament grow up to have anxiety disorders. But for me, and this is all sort of dimly remembered, but in some cases acutely, like just this fear, I had acute separation anxiety from as, you know, early as I can remember. And I would be convinced. So, like when I was a little kid, my mom went to law school at nights. And when I was in elementary school, we'd have a babysitter that would be home when we got home. And then, you know, my parents would always tell me what time they were going to come home. And I knew the time. And yet I became convinced if they were like not home 15 minutes before that time, that they were dead. And it wasn't like I thought maybe they were dead. I like was 100% convinced that they were dead, and I would worry, and I literally wore grooves in the carpet of my bedroom, running, you know, just pacing around mm-hmm. in circles, you know, and I would like, you know, try to pray. I'd say, okay, you know, please God, let the fourth car that comes down the street like be my mom's car. And I, you know, kind of, I'd force myself not to look at the first three cars, and then I look at the fourth car, and still not her. And then finally, you know, every night they would eventually come home, and I would be, you know, filled with your relief and euphoria, and like, oh, thank God, they're still alive. And then the next night I would go through the exact same thing again. And then if I was at a friend's house or whatever, like I couldn't do sleepovers, you know, I think, you know, it was really embarrassing for me when I was at, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and I would go to like, you know, my day camp would have it one overnight, and I would just be like crying by the camp counselors for like no apparent reason other than that I was homesick and wanted to go home. Mm-hmm. So that was an early manifestation of my just general, you know, anxious set of stuff. The other one was from a very early age, and this one I think, you know, again, whether this is genetics or, you know, sort of social acculturation from watching my mother. My mother had an acute fear of vomiting, which yep. is a, I'm actually learning, you know, it's not common, but it's much less uncommon than was thought. Mm-hmm. And I have, since publishing the book, heard from lots of people who have that. But anyway, she was afraid of it, less afraid than I subsequently became. But for me, starting when I was about 7 years old, it was just like an absolute terror for me, and I would go through and still go through my whole life, you know, afraid of contamination from germs, afraid of eating the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. I am always like intensely aware of who, you know, going when I was in high school, like who was out sick. You know, I was basically, you could have like asked me what the attendance was, like, oh, he was out last Wednesday. I actually still get like, you know, now I get Google, like I can actually have like a, you know, global epidemiological, like, you know, like NORAD center in my head, and I can tell mm-hmm. you like which nursing homes in like, you know, Venezuela are shut down because of a norovirus outbreak, which is not normal or healthy. But so it just it became this sort of all-consuming mm-hmm. thing, and that was sort of my first like specific phobia, and that really affected my life because it would start to affect what I would eat and where I would go, and it compounded the separation anxiety and sort of like my incipient agoraphobia because I was afraid to go anywhere where I wouldn't have control over who was preparing the food. Mm-hmm. Or I also developed this related, and it's unclear whether this is like a phobia or just like an aversion, but to me cheese smells like vomit.
Yep.
And so I like couldn't
all cheese?
Pretty much all cheese.
Pretty much all cheese.
Yeah.
So you don't have pizza?
everyone always asks me that, and that makes like going to sleepovers when you're like,
right, that's, all they serve.
That's all they would serve. So it was always this whole thing where I'd have to like bring an apple and a peanut butter sandwich, and it just like it was very tiring to be me. And then added to that, so I had all that going on, and then around about sixth grade, I suddenly developed. And I can remember the moment it happened where I was, in the sixth grade school play. And I'd done little plays before that and stuff like that. But I was supposed to be St. George in St. George and the Dragon. And I came out to say my line. And we're talking about nervous excitement. Mm-hmm. I had been feeling, I thought, nervously excited. And I came out and I just couldn't speak. It was like, I don't know if you've seen the episode of Brady Bunch where Cindy Brady, like the red light goes on and she just can't. And again, this tied in also with me to the vomiting phobia, because I felt like my stomach hurt, I felt like if I spoke, I would throw up.
Right.
And so, like, I literally go out there, and it was horrible. I'm frozen. And fortunately, the guy who was who was playing my valet, just said the next line, and we kind of moved, and I got through it. And actually, that guy turned out, ended up being, that was Peter Orszag. He was the, he became head of the Bureau of the Budget under Barack Obama years later, so he was not anxious.
that you know of.
Well, yeah, and fathered a whole bunch of kids out of, from different moms at the same time. And it was very, he had a very colorful life that was probably from not having enough anxiety, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe. But that's a thing, right? I mean, so you wrote this book and people were shocked. Like, your coworkers had no idea. Or didn't allow themselves to know.
I really think they didn't. Most of them, I mean, I had some close friends who were like, yeah, we always thought you were kind of weird. and there were things that I would be open about, like about my cheese aversion.
Yeah.
But they did not know, and I talked about like the types of therapy I've tried and the many, many kinds of medication and just some of the horrifying, harrowing, anxious experiences and embarrassing experiences produced by my anxiety. And that I had all kept hidden.
So let's talk about like you're treating this thing, because in the book you've got this fight between psychology and psychiatry, and I think that's it, because a lot of people don't know the difference between those. So can you talk a little bit about the you've got Dr. Harvard, Dr. Stanford is how you classify them.
Yeah, so in the way I tell the story in the book, what happened was, so I had published a book in 2004. It was my first book, and I was terrified about the speaking tour that was going to come with the book tour. I mean, just like, and I've been in therapy for years at this point. I was in my early 30s, but I was like, I cannot do this. And I was so anxious that like I would just, if I saw someone else having to give a talk, I would have a panic attack. In fact, I had a panic attack watching Mean Girls, the movie, when Tim Meadows was playing the headmaster. It was that bad. And I was like, I'm not going to be able to get through this. So my regular psychiatrist sent me to a psychopharmacologist who specializes in, prescribing different kinds of medication. And he basically said, and he like takes my case study, he's like, yeah, you have a really bad set of anxiety disorders. You're really hardwired biologically for anxiety. We just need to get you properly medicated. This is really easy to treat. We're going to give you these medications for it, which were basically an antidepressant and benzodiazepines, which are an anti-anxiety medication. So I was like, great, but I still was super anxious. So I also went to this place called the Boston University Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, which is focused on what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is basically a form of therapy that is based on a combination of exposing yourself to the thing that you're afraid of. So if you're afraid of heights, you go up to higher and higher things, mm-hmm. or whatever, and you acclimate to it, and then reframing how you think about it and basically retraining your brain. And it's studies show it's actually quite effective. So I'm, doing that on the one hand and going to Dr. Harvard. And Dr. Harvard is saying, we'll take these medications. The first time I go to see, I called Dr. Harvard because he was at Harvard. I go to this other woman who I called Dr. Stanford because she was Stanford trained. And she says, we need to just retrain you, but you have to give up your medications because that's keeping you from, really experiencing your anxiety, which is true. And so she said, let me take your medication away. And she actually opened up her drawer and showed me, like, she had a whole drawer full of her other patients whose
meds
they'd confiscated. She confiscated, and she's like, holds it up and shakes it. And I was like, I don't know about that. So I go back to Dr. Harvard, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, I went to this other woman and she said that, like, I can't actually address the underlying anxiety if I don't expose myself to it. So I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be taking it. He's like, yeah, well, your anxiety is so bad that, like, even mild stress triggers it, and you're not going to be able to do effective behavioral therapy if you don't, like, take the edge off it. So, mm-hmm. you know, you mm-hmm. really probably should be on this. So I go back to Dr. Stanford and I say, well, actually, Dr. Harvard said, you know, I really need to be on it. And I honestly thought she was going to cry. Like, it was like mm-hmm. I was betraying her. So after that, I stopped telling her that I was still seeing Dr. Harvard, like, mm-hmm. it was sort of, like, illicit. But it really did speak to exactly mm-hmm. what you're asking about, which is this, like, there are these different modes, and yeah, the medication prescribing psychiatrists and psychopharmacologists tend to default just by nature of their training and the paradigm they're operating within, and because of, you know, insurance and stuff, to, like, I'm going to see you for 15 minutes. The most efficient thing for me to do is to give you an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety
sure.
medication. The CBT people and other kinds of talk therapists and psychologists and social workers say, no, you need to talk about the underlying trauma, you need to expose yourself to this, you need to try these other things, and actually medication can be, it can be helpful, but it can be counterproductive, and it's not the center of it. And there's not, you know, there's plenty of people who agree that there's a middle ground where you need a little bit of both,
mm-hmm.
but there's also disputes. And so I thought this was quite interesting. That's partly what led me to look into the book. I mean, since then, I continue to follow this, and the field is still kind of riven by all this stuff. And interestingly, you know, in recent years, all the early promise about the effectiveness of Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and that of the SSRI, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor class of medications that were, like, super, you know, common in the culture and widely prescribed in the 90s and the 2000s. It's not so clear they really work. I mean, I still take them. So,
right.
And I say, you know, so the fact that statistically they're not shown to work very well, they clearly work for some people. But Big Pharma, who, you know, had tried to make a lot of money, is basically moving away from all this and saying, we give up. We don't know.
Right.
And there's other things sort of further down the pipeline where they hope that some of these things will turn out to be effective. But most of these things turn out to be marginally better than placebo, which, you know, basically means, like, I could give you a sugar pill and tell you it would work for your anxiety, and maybe it would, or it would work as well as, you know, whatever thing. Now, having said that, I have been taking different SSRIs more or less continuously now for 23 years. So,
you're like, maybe not, but I'm still going to take them.
I mean, I would like to not be taking them, but I'm like, but what if I, you know, and,
right,
I have, you know, a couple times when I've tried to go off, I know it, you know, suddenly it's like, now is that withdrawal, you know, that you can develop mm-hmm. sort of physical dependency. With the SRIs, it's not dangerous like an opioid addiction or anything like that, but you do feel the withdrawal. And so, you know, could I just wait that out? And it's tough to know. And then, there, you know, you sometimes hear scary stories about people who go off and then, you know, just really go off the rails.
Right.
And I'm not keen to subject myself to that. So,
we're in about 10 minutes. I'm going to come to you for questions. Bye, Andrew. But a couple more things I want to talk to you about. You talk in the book about some celebrities and historical figures who've experienced this. And the one that was really interesting to me, because my dad... huge Celtics fan from Boston, and his favorite player was Bill Russell, who was an amazing player. Also suffered terrible anxiety.
Yes. Well, and this is—it's funny you bring him up, because in my current therapy sessions, we talk a lot about Bill Russell.
Okay.
Funnily enough, because so what Bill Russell would do. So he was a. You know, great basketball players, was on the Celtics 50s through the 70s, won more championships than anyone. But before, like, most high-pressure games, he would vomit from anxiety. And, in fact, when they went, there was a period of time when he stopped throwing up before every game, and they started losing. He started playing badly because he wasn't anxious enough. And it's sort of this idea you need a certain, like, minimum level of, like, activation and excitement. The difference between him, and this is what my therapist says to me, is that, like, you need to make yourself more like Bill Russell. Not, I'm never going to be a better basketball player, but that for Bill Russell, he would have the physiological, and again, this gets to the exciting thing, he would have the physiological activation of, I got this big game, it's doing things to my body, it's making me sick, and now I'm going to go out and play great and kick ass.
Which you did.
I have that nervous anticipation. It makes me feel sick. I am terrified, and I retreat into a fetal ball and am completely non-functional.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of the meaning that I attach to the feeling sick to my stomach mm-hmm. is completely different from what his is. But mm-hmm. anyway, yes. Yeah, so, and there are other examples too, like Hank Paulson, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, I think. There was a famous story in Vanity Fair where the guy goes to interview and he keeps leaving, and like the economy is melting down. Mm-hmm. And he's this big, you know, he'd come from the, you know, private sector where he'd made billions of dollars, rich, big swaggering guy. He clearly was just like anxious and worn out. And he keeps leaving the interview to go throw up audibly in the bathroom next door. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is, you know, and again, my therapist is like, you just need to be more like Hank Paul. Like he was feeling physically anxious as a result of this. It just didn't bother him.
So. How about like someone like William James?
The psychiatrist? The psychologist?
Yeah. And some of the other historical figures you talk about.
Well, I mean, there's one. I actually found, and people who have talked to me about the book like say that they agree with me, that one of the things I found most consoling was finding all these like super accomplished people who like dealt with like crippling anxiety and sometimes crippling physical anxiety. And so like everyone from like, you know, William James would have horrible panic attacks.
Or all the Jameses, I think.
They were like a big neurotic mess, and yet, you know, went on to become great novelists, psychologists. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Darwin had, you know, he may have had physical ailments that were related to this, but was, you know, plagued by anxiety, depression, misery, had to actually build a little special screen in his study to vomit behind because he would be so mm-hmm. overwhelmed by emotion and then would get sick to his stomach, and yet, you know, went on to develop the theory of evolution. Gandhi, as a public speaker, you know, the first time he tried to public speak, he goes up and he was shaking so hard he couldn't read what was on the mm-hmm. scrap of paper. You know, he some other famous orators from you know, ancient Greece and Rome, you know, Demosthenes were famous for, like, you know, not being able to mm-hmm. Speak sometimes. So for me, it was just quite reassuring. Or like Gladstone, who was a British prime minister, would take laudanum, which is basically opium, in his coffee in order before every speech he gave to mm-hmm. Parliament because he would be so anxious. Laurence Olivier, you know, as actors among you, you know, can relate to, like, here was a guy, he was, brilliant actor. Mm-hmm. And like quit the stage, I guess, for a while because he just couldn't deal with the stage fright. And every time, for at least periods of time, he would be completely miserable. And of course, he would always pull himself together and be brilliant and never medicated, as far as I know. So there's tons of examples like that, right. And I just found that very consoling for some reason.
Well, my experience here was, I remember we were doing a PSA for destigmatizing social anxiety, and the corporate division had come over to me, and I was running the theater at the time, and said, do you know if we have any people here who like suffer from this? I'm like, oh, I'm sure we do, let's send out an email. And it was like the flood that came back from all these people. I'm like, why would you choose to be an actor if you had such a and why would you choose improvisation where you have no script? And what became increasingly interesting, and we discovered this in our classes, is that actually people did seek it out as a way to treat themselves.
That's interesting. I was wondering about that.
So, and in fact, a psychiatrist took the classes, noticed that, and started using our classes as his group. So he'd recommend people to come here and do that, and we ended up forming a improv for anxiety program out of it. But indeed, they were sort of maybe doing the throwing up thing of that scariness, you know. And so much of the improv world is about taking the emphasis off yourself, mm-hmm. like giving you all this way of like pushing it off. And the data that we work with the behavioral science community shows that most people aren't thinking about us, they're thinking about themselves.
Right.
You know, people are deeply thinking about themselves. So your ability to do that, it can be amazing.
And when you say pushing it off yourself, like just in your own mind, like focus. Don't think about, like focus outward on the
focus
audience
outward.
Or whatever.
So much of our exercises are about, Saul Bellow calls it being a first class noticer. You know, the idea of like, I need to put my attention completely and thoroughly on you. I'm not going to even worry about what I'm saying. That's going to happen. It's fine. My wife often sort of has referred to our work as like loud group mindfulness. And what's interesting too is you talk about the potential benefits of anxiety, and you write, quote, social phobics are, in at least this one respect, gifted, faster and better at picking up behavioral cues from other people, and social antennae so sensitive that they receive transmissions that normal people can't. There's a behavioral scientist, Dacher Keltner, who also talks about, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he's done a lot of studies that basically say poor people are seeing more truth than rich people. Because they have to.
Interesting. I mean, just in order to survive.
In order to survive, they've got to be noticing what's going on in the room. They've got to be aware of the status cues. They've got to be worried about, you know, getting arrested and other things that they can't, because they can't. It is truly life-threatening, as opposed to those of us who are very privileged, are just walking along in our ways like, everything's great.
Yep.
We don't know what they're complaining about. So I'm wondering, too, in this discussion of trying to figure out what all this is about, you know, how much is it about what's going on here, societal, modern life, all of that. It's very, and it sounds to me like as much study as that you've done, you don't have the answer.
No. I mean, I have a lot of questions, but don't have the answer. And I mean, it is what you mentioned about the people have social phobia. So, you know, there are a couple species of social anxiety. There's the, you know, classic public speaking phobia, which I have in spades. But then there's the more, like, just at the interpersonal level, like, you go, you know, afraid of, like, interacting at work or going to a cocktail party. It's just, like, and I have that to a lesser degree, but, like, some people have it much more acutely than I do. And that's what you're talking about, where, you know, it is this, like, the inability to get out of your own head because you're so self-consciously, instead of just thinking, you know, looking, you know, thinking about what the other person is saying and responding, you're self-monitoring, like, how is what I'm saying being perceived by her? What, you know, is she looking bored? And the truth is, they're actually better at picking up that, like, maybe she is looking bored, but maybe she isn't. They're also good at sort of reading negative interpretations into those things. That relates to a theory called depressive realism, which is that people who are depressed or anxious are actually more realistic in their, you know, in perceiving the world and their and you know, people's views of them. That, like, yeah, that guy did kind of snub me, or he was kind of dickish to me, or maybe he is angry at me. Whereas happier, healthier people have this kind of adaptive blunting where they're just not aware. They're like, it is also true that they got snubbed, but they, like, didn't notice and don't care, which is the healthier, most of the time, way to go about it.
But really hard.
And I would say that if you can learn how to, and this is where the, can you take the kind of problem, you know, the misery of different kinds of anxiety, but, like, you know, the skillful social noticing of social anxiety and the heightened antennae and the hypervigilance that's part of all anxiety, and sort of take that out of the realm of I'm just looking for disaster and thinking all about myself, and actually use that, it could make you a better manager because you're better able to see how people are interacting. You can see how to make people, you know, play well together in whatever situation. You can just foresee bad things coming in a more effective way, not in a, oh, the sky is falling, I'm panicking because I'm anxious. It's, I actually can foresee these things because I have that hyper vigilance. So this is where, if you can take it out of the realm of, like, really debilitating clinical anxiety into harnessing it and applying it, it can be a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much of this comes down to framing, you know, in many contexts, that you realize the power of that. The way we frame something, the way someone else frames something, can make all the difference in the world. And to have agency inside that, it's certainly not taught in school. And so where are people picking up on this? But that, my experience is the people who have the ability to, Danny Kahneman, who's this brilliant, behavioral economist, they say he sees the world as a problem. But that's not problematic for him. He gamifies it.
Yeah.
And it allows him then to look at something and be like, I probably have this wrong. And this is the thing I've sort of, since studying this work, and then coming out of the school of improvisation, the idea of it being wrong is also where all the good comedy comes from. Because no one wants to hear my story about everything fantastic. Like, you want to hear the fiasco. That is the best story. Like, your Hyannisport story. Yeah. Is, you know, you've got this fiasco. So here's what I want you to tell that story, if you're okay with it. Because it's a great fiasco story. And then we'll come to you for questions, all right? So this is in the book.
Yes. So it's been a while since I've told this story, but it's seared into my memory. when I was working on my first book, which was a biography of, as Kelly mentioned, I think, of Sergeant Shriver, who's the founder of the Peace Corps and a brother-in-law of the Kennedy family. This was in the late 90s. I spent much of a summer of 1997 out at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport. And and for me, as like a 20-something kid, I was sort of like, you know, just like taking in the grounds, and there were always like all these famous random people there, Arnold Schwarzenegger, or whatever. But anyway, one day, you know, I decided to go for a walk. And I should say, just as a small bit of background, which could be a whole other topic for discussion, mm-hmm. that like there is also a powerful link between both depression and anxiety and kind of gut disturbances, bowel trouble, gastrointestinal distress, which I've suffered from my entire life in conjunction with my anxiety. So with that bit of background established, I went out for a walk one day before dinner. And again, this was, you know, that particular weekend, Bill Clinton was like off sailing with Ted Kennedy on Nantucket Sound, and Liza Minnelli was there, and the Secretary of the Navy, I think. And JFK Jr. and the fashion photographer Herb Ritz. I didn't even put this in the book because I didn't think people would believe me. Anyway, suddenly, like, I'm far away from the house. I'm realizing I got to get back to the bathroom because, like, it's an emergency. And I'm sort of like looking around. Is there some like outhouse or tennis court or something where I could find a bathroom on the way up? But there's not. So I get back, and there's a mansion where I was staying, and the bedroom where I was kind of up on the second floor, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to make my way, you know, up mm-hmm. there, and I'm like praying, like, please don't let me run into anyone, like, I'm now sweating, you know, mm-hmm. And I get to the front door, and I'm like, I can't make it to my bedroom, like, and I can hear there's people there, so if I try to make it through, someone's going to talk to me, and I'm just going to, like, have an accident right there in the middle of the living room. So I come in the front door, and then I knew there was a bathroom just inside the door to the right. So I duck in there, close the door, and fortunately it was like there's kind of a little ante room, you know, go through there, go into the bathroom, sit down, go about my business, flush, and something happens. And I'm like, uh-oh. And basically the plumbing, like, failed, and suddenly there's like the water is just like, you know, coming out the bottom of the toilet, and you know, my pants are on the floor, and I was just like, oh my god, like, what am I gonna do? So I'm like, oh crap, literally. So I'm frantically like trying to stop the thing from overflowing. I take off my clothes. I'm like trying to mop them up. I'm picking up paper towel, or actually not just paper towels, but like the actual towels. Trying to mop, you know, sop up the stuff. It's now like a lake, a fecal lake. So I'm trying to clean everything up, and I'm like, you know, like sweating, trying to get things under control, focusing only on that, and then I hear a bell ring, and that is the bell for dinner. And when they ring the dinner bell, it basically means everyone musters in the living room right outside the bathroom where I am. So I'm like, oh crap, like what do I do now? So I'm like, okay, I have two choices. I can either just like hunker down in here, like bar the door and just try to wait, like just stay here for like days, I don't know. Or I can like quickly, like before people come, try to make a run for it. So I'm like, I kind of listen at the door, and like I haven't heard people yet, so I'm like, all right, I'll make a run for it. So my clothes are like completely like filthy now. So I took like all the dirty towels, shoved them under the sink. I'm like, I'll come back and deal with those later. I take the least dirty towel and wipe it, sort of wrap it around my waist, I'm still wearing my shirt or whatever. So I listen at the door, and I like don't hear anything. I peek out, don't say anything. And so there's a staircase that kind of goes like that. And so, you know, I come right out, go up the stairs to here. I get to the landing. I'm fine. Come up like this, and coming this way is JFK Jr. I'd met him for the first time that weekend, and he just goes, and I was like, oh my god, like, what? And he just goes, hey Scott, how's it going? Like, as though people running around, like, in, you know, soiled towels is a normal thing before dinner. I'm like, good. And he just keeps going, and I keep going. I go to my room, and in my room, I had my own bathroom and shower, so I, like, you know, clean up, shower, whatever. you know, and then I go to dinner, and the whole time I'm still kind of like breathing and mm-hmm. sweating, and then after dinner I had to like wait till everyone went to bed, and then go down like to the pantry and find like a giant hefty bag to go, because I stashed all that stuff under the mm-hmm. under the sink, and then it was a rash, because, and like I said, Bill Clinton had been there that weekend, and so the Secret Service had been like, mm-hmm. so I was convinced I was going to get like, you know, shot, or at least like, or like, why is this guy like dumping stuff in the dumpster? And yeah. Nobody knows. Anyway, and they, so anyway, I put this in the book, and I even had to throw out the rug that was in there. I mean, yeah. it was everything. And they claim never to have realized. I was like, what are the people like going to fix? Like when the cleaning people come, like what right. happened to all the towels? anyway, that was a very. I mean, that was among the more extreme of my anxiety related misadventures, but not atypical.
But so. I think that whole point that they didn't know is part of what we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
We think, because you're building all of this out, you are. Oh wow. I love that story.
Yeah.
It's terrible. It's terrible. Okay, questions for Scott. We can cover anything.
Yeah. I just have a comment real quick. And when we speak about this hyper-awareness, my background is in stage acting, which is literally my job to know what my partner is thinking on stage. And so I notice how those things, now that they've actually turned into skills that I can mm-hmm. market, mm-hmm. but I notice them in my everyday life when I'm having a conversation with someone and I'm overanalyzing everything that's going on in their face. Luckily, I find a healthy outlet to put it into my work, something I'm passionate about, but I just had to say that.
I think the important thing, we forget that habits, skills, that like this is about building up a particular skill. Mm-hmm. And you need, you know, for habit change, you can't read a book and make a habit change. Mm-hmm. That you have to have some, what they call the learning loop. But, I mean, again, when you're, it's like you have every intention to not feel this way.
Yeah.
And you have the privilege of access to all the great thinking around this and seeing doctors. And yet, there's nothing, it's not cured. And I think it is that way for most people.
Well, no, and it's funny you began with the flying thing, because that's a classic example for me, because I can sit here now and be like, there's nothing abstract, you know, in the abstract, there's nothing dangerous about flying, or nothing more dangerous than driving over here from my hotel.
Worse.
That is more dangerous. And I know, too, like, exactly, or, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I've read enough to know, like, exactly kind of what the series of neural mm-hmm. neural, you know, transmissions and, you know, activations in my brain that are happening when I am in that. So I'm like, oh, this is just, like, I can abstract it and just think of it as, like, a science experiment, and it's not statistically dangerous anyway. So I'm fine. The moment, like, I'm in that plane and then suddenly bump, all that is just instantly out the window.
Gone.
I mean, gone. And literally, like, the you know, amygdala part of my brain that is just hyperactive just takes over, and I'm like, and I will at that point, you know, consume whatever I need to consume, jump out the window, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to get over it, in theory, demonstrated, is exactly what you say, is to, like, you know, I should fly
practice,
or like go up with a crazy, you know, stunt pilot and have to deal with, you know, and then eventually you acclimate.
But you're not going to do it.
No.
Let me this very round, so everyone's got a question.
Do you think that you can develop new anxiety as you get older, more anxieties? Like the flying thing, I recently developed a flight anxiety, and I grew up flying. Like, my first flight was when I was a baby. I never had a problem until a few years ago, and now I experience the same thing, and I'm like, how? What?
Yeah. Did you have a traumatic, was there a bad flight?
So I think what it was I kind of noticed it shortly after I was in Russia when they shot the plane down mm-hmm. over Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of scary, but it wasn't as if I was necessarily traumatized, but I noticed shortly after that event, all of a sudden, I'm fine. Before the flight, I don't think about it, but it's as soon as we hit a bump, and I'm just like,
Well, I think it could be that, I mean, that does happen, that you develop it later in life, and it could be that you made a, you know, conscious connection between that story that you heard about the Ukraine plane getting shot down, and then suddenly, like, well, wait, that can happen. And then it gets kind of at some deeper level. And, I mean, Kelly, you were saying earlier about, like, that you've later in life developed
Bridges.
And I know other people who, again, had no history of anxiety, also bridges, for me, in researching the book, you know, I have many, many phobias, but one thing that I'd never had any trouble with was getting my blood drawn. I was just like, whatever, that's fine. And then I read about how that is a phobia that a lot of people have and how it causes, like, some people to pass out. And, of course, and I associate that with fear. And then I became completely phobic about getting my blood drawn. So, like, basically in researching the book, I gave myself a whole new phobia. So, yeah, you can get them later.
Yes.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on yoga and meditation and how that could apply to anxiety?
My thoughts are they apply very, very well. And I wish that I could apply them better. no, I mean, in fact, I know more. I mean, I know that they relate. I know more about the meditation, both from my research and from my own therapy. And so what I know from the research is that, which is totally fascinating, is that there are, like, lots of studies that just show that even limited amounts of doing, you know, developing a mindfulness meditation practice, you know, increases your feelings of well-being, lowers your level of stress, reduces your propensity to anxiety. And then they can actually look in your brain and see that, like, you know, the parts of your brain that are in charge of, like, conscious decision-making, stuff, like, grow and become more densely connected, and the fear section shrinks. So, I mean, by doing that, you are literally exerting mind over matter and changing the structure of the brain to make it less anxious. In my own, you know, with my current therapist and with previous therapists, I mean, I think it's a kind of a classic thing that people who most are in need of yoga and mindfulness are, like, the worst at it, because, like, it's very hard to sit still. Your, you know, thoughts go everywhere. But even the little bit of mindfulness practice that I've tried to do, and I've, you know, I do find helps. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole elaborate set of theories, you know, some coming from Eastern philosophy, some just coming from current neuroscience. You know, the guy I work with now is very practiced at it himself. You know, it's a way of, if you can just, it relates to the exposure therapy too, because if you can adopt, is what he's trying to get me to do, you know, when I'm in that throes of that anxious state on the airplane, instead of just, like, staying in that fight or flight state, I mean, I'm going to be having those sensations. If I could somehow just sit with it and not be like, I need to escape this moment at all costs, but somehow accept it. I mean, this is, like, high degree of, you have to get better at it. But with, at lower levels, like, if you're feeling uncomfortable, you're feeling pain or whatever, just sit with it and accept it. Don't try to change it. And your brain gets more practice at just, like, sitting with it, and then you get better at being able to endure it. And one of the weird kind of, I don't know if it's catch 22, but paradox of anxiety is, like, the more you're able to accept anxiety, the less anxiety you have. So there's tons and tons of data that stuff's really good. I mean, and for me, sort of related, like, at regular exercise is like medicine for me. And if I, it just sort of establishes a baseline of well-being that it doesn't protect me completely from anxiety at all. But I do feel better and less anxious when I can do that. So
we're involved in a study right now at the University of California, San Francisco, with Dr. Charles Lim, who's one of the first neuroscientists to study the human brain when it improvises. So he did it with jazz musicians, he did it with rappers, and now he's doing it with us, theatrical improvisers. And the study so far is very clear that when you are improvising, you are in a different creative state. And that creative state is less fearful.
Interesting.
So he was basically like, we could stop the study right now and just explore that, and it would be fascinating. But, you know, we're going on further from there.
But how does that... See, I'm curious, because for me, I feel like I'd be so afraid of being judged for just sucking at the improvising.
Well, you can, so here's the thing. You can't improvise well if you're in your fear brain.
Right. Well, then I wouldn't be.
Then you wouldn't be. But
you're saying if you're improvising unless you're...
Yeah, if we get... I don't know if we should get you early or whatever. But in theory, the practice of improvisation over and over and over again, you failed so much that you've built up your resilience. And you lose that. Yeah.
That makes sense.
That's it. Here, we go back.
Does your religious or spiritual views shape the way that you handle your anxiety? I know that for some, I'll pray to Jesus, let's say, and, you know, he'll help me, or because I'm now fearful of, to use your example, if you don't mind, fearful of bridges, that could be a past life coming in, and something happened where there was a trauma in the past life, and now you're in a spiritual sense. So do you kind of take all of those views to perhaps help you or help others, or how do you kind of view religious or spiritual?
Good question. I'll start at the abstract and then try to bring it down to me. I mean, I didn't get into this that much in the book, but there is some research suggesting that people who have deep faith of whatever kind, doesn't matter what your faith tradition is, have less anxiety. And which makes sense to me, you know, logically, that like if you believe that there is a design or that there is a creator who is sort of watching out for you, you'll feel. Now, I come from a kind of a mixed religious background. My mother was kind of Episcopalian WASP, which is what we were raised as. My dad was Jewish. We weren't even told we were Jewish. I joke that it's like I'm like Woody Allen trapped in John Calvin, which is like I'm like neurotic Jew trapped in like a repressed neurotic WASP. But I was basically kind of reluctant agnostic, and I didn't have much of much spirituality. And again, I wouldn't say I was a hardcore atheist, but I didn't have a strong faith. And I tried, like when my anxiety got really bad, you know. And there's been times when it's been worse than others. Like in the summer, when I was trying to finish that first book, I was switching medications, mm-hmm. and I was just like being, you know, ravaged by panic attacks. And so I could hardly function. So I would like. One thing I would do, I would walk around and I would go to a church in Boston and like just look at sit in the back of the church and look at the picture of Jesus. It was a very sort of serene photo or painting of him, and I would try to just like look at it and try to like derive calm from it and pray to him, not really knowing who or what I'm praying to. I don't think, you know, it would calm me down a little bit, but then I sort of abandoned that. And to bring it up to the present day, like I had kind of a bad patch a year ago, just under a year ago, and was talking to a counselor who was sort of asking me like how I was in my spiritual life, and I was like, well, I don't really know. I mean, I didn't have a spiritual life, I realized, and I didn't care because I didn't think it mattered. Since then, I've started to develop one. I've talked to a lot of people. I'm in some groups where we like talk about that kind of thing. I still don't know what I believe, but I have started to pray. So, like, I pray in the morning and just saying, sort of, please, you know, give me help with this. And at night, thank you. Again, don't know exactly what I'm praying to, but I do, through the practice of doing this, which is almost a form of meditation in a weird way, like, start to develop this sense of, again, it's nothing as concrete as an actual, like, presence yet. But I do find myself, because the sorts of things that I try and ask for help with, I'm not saying I want more money or a house. I'm like, help me be more of service, you know, today, and help me, I'll say help, you know, keep my anxiety at bay and stuff like that. But I feel myself like actually developing a better sense of grounding and just feeling better about myself. So that was a long-winded way of saying that actually I do think there is a way in which spirituality can become kind of like a bubble wrap that protects you against like certain forms of anxiety. And I, you know, I just from like some experience in like 12-step traditions, like for them, you know, that developing that spirituality is like being in a spiritual condition is like very important to like staying in a steady state and staying away from drugs or alcohol. So I think it can be crucially important.
Answering question.
Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of examples of celebrities like William James or Bill Russell who use their anxiety as a good thing. Mm-hmm. So exactly how does one do that, use anxiety as to boost themselves?
So I don't know if it's a it's basically, if you imagine a bell curve, and there are actually studies about this, you know, that like in any kind of performance, like whether you're taking the bar exam or doing an improv performance or playing an NBA basketball game, you know, if over here is like no anxiety at all, and over here is extreme anxiety, if you're at the extreme and on the vertical axis here is performance, if you're extremely anxious, like so anxious that you can't function, like I sometimes get, or you're having a panic attack and you're just like shivering in the corner, your performance is going to be way down here. You're not going to be effective. But if you're not anxious at all, like, so if you're doing an improv mm-hmm. performance and you're just like, you're right, the audience will feel that there's like a lack of energy. Or if you're in a basketball game, it's like with Bill Russell when he wasn't playing well in those games. So your performance will also be pretty low. What you want is kind of that optimal level of like Goldilocks just right anxiety, which is like here. So the bell curve is like this. So if you can, you know, you want to have just the right amount of anxiety that's here that gets you peak performance. And so that's, I think, what's happening in the case of Bill Russell or, you know, some of these other folks, is like they need that anxiety to give them that edge. And again, there's a physiological, you know, your vision improves. It's again, harnessing, if you're at an athletic thing, it's mm-hmm. harnessing the fight or flight. It's the hypervigilance. You're more aware of things. You're just, your blood flow to your brain is more potent, I guess, so you can think better. So it happens in all those ways. I think there are other ways too, where you could, you know, really try to harness it. I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. I mean, there are plenty of cases where it's not. Another celebrity was Hugh Grant, who, you know, later in his career, just developed, like, every time they turned the cameras on, he would start having panic attacks and start mm-hmm. sweating. I think he retired for a while.
Yeah.
So it's not always adaptive.
But I think Renee Fleming as well. So,
is that right?
Yeah. So Renee told me, because we did a production with her, that she almost had to quit performing completely because of her panic. And I remember she sang the national anthem at the Super Bowl a couple of years ago. And after she finished, I texted her and said, "Hey, great job. That was terrific." And she called me and goes, "I didn't think it was very good." And it's like, I'm like, "Why? Why are you calling? Like, you're fucking Renee Fleming, like you're." And then really, like, I had to talk her down. I'm like, "I can't believe this is happening right now." And then call me back later, and she goes, "You know what I'm like." And I'm like, "Yeah, was my text a good thing?" She goes, "No, it was, because I was like in a state."
That is another gift thing that, and this is where, like, the similarity between anxious people and depressed people, and they're both gifted at finding the negative in the positive and discounting the positive. And, you know, so that's interesting.
Yeah. We got time for one more. Yeah.
So I was wondering, like, how, if you separate kind of, like, anxiety and, like, from yourself, and, like, how that works, because I've had, like, therapists be like, you know, you can think of, like, your anxiety and depression as, like, this thing that you can, like, fight and destroy, but, like, for me, I feel like it's a part of me, too, and it's, like, it's hard to separate, like, who you are, so you want to, like, control it, but it's also, like, it's hard to be like, oh, this is, like, this thing that I have to defeat, because then also because it, like, will never really go away, you know, like, it can't be cured, it's just managing.
Yep. No, interesting question, and I don't have a definitive answer to that. It's bound up, well, and you hear a lot of people, I mean, these days talk about saying, like, in the language, like, you don't say, I'm not anxious, I have anxiety, you know, it's, and you're trying to separate your identity from the disease, which is a thing that happens to you, like, I am not diabetes, I have diabetes. I mean, I don't, but if I did, for me, it's bound up with, too, the questions of, like, medicating, because, and this is where, you know, is the medication, some of the medication is, like, treating the symptoms and trying to make you less anxious or depressed, but is that also affect, you know, by definition, because it's going into your brain and changing your brain chemistry, it's changing how you think, and maybe at some level who you are, which kind of freaks me out a little bit. And again, I say this as someone who's taken lots of medications over the years, but it's always with some misgivings for that very reason. So yeah, I'm curious, like, what? How did you work that out? Like,
I guess I'm still figuring it out too. But I think, like, yeah, for me, it's like, it's weird. It is, because I've, like, been on meds, and then, like, now I'm off meds, like, trying to figure that out. And it is, like, it's a weird thing of trying to manage it. But I also, I think part of that is, like, the embracing the anxiety too, and, like, the benefits that it can give me, and, like, that helps too, because I'm like, well, yes, I'll always be anxious, but, like, if I can get rid of some of the symptoms, but know that, like, my anxiety can benefit me, and so, like, that's a good part of it and a good part of my personality.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that too, because that is something that we haven't really talked about, is that to the degree that there are, even if it's, I mean, we talked a little bit about, like, there are specific things about anxiety and even clinical anxiety that can be good and helpful, but there are things that are allied, that may be allied to anxiety or even to depression, that are adaptive and that are tied to things, you know, other parts of you that are good. I mean, if you are if you are prone to depression, it may mean that you have a sensitive artistic sensibility that you know, not all depressed people are sensitive, and not all sensitive people are artistic people are depressed. But, you know, it may be that there are good things, and if you can own those, there's also the whole question of stigma. And, you know, for me, I struggle with, like, trying to embrace the anxiety, like, this is part of me. I still feel like it just, you know, particularly as, and I think it's sometimes different for men, like, it's a shameful thing. I think it's bound up in, like, feeling like I was always going to get beat up in high school for being a loser or something. But, like, you know, if I show weakness or if I admit anxiety, that makes me less of a man. It makes me, you know, and so it's like that I'm trying to like distance myself from it or stuff it down. And that doesn't really work. So
we're also, you know, we're still so bound in the approach from the negative, right? And something like the positive psychology movement, which rather than you walk in the door, they find out what's right with you, you know, so what's working for you, and then going from there. And my friend Scott Barry Kaufman has a really lovely book called Ungifted, because he was always put in those ungifted programs, and he's, you know, a PhD at Barnard with, you know, multiple books. And he had a learning disability, and he processes things differently, and he has to listen in a different way. But it all also makes him sort of uniquely situated in the world to offer a kind of a point of view. And we just don't know enough yet, because it's a new phenomenon, whether that's going to be a way that you can incorporate it into your narrative. You know, from an improv point of view, all that stuff is good stuff people with lots of anxiety have turned into their wonderful stand-up careers or improvisational careers. It was funny when you mentioned Mean Girls, because I was like, oh, somewhere Tina Fey's husband is having a panic attack right now. Yeah, literally on our trip to Vienna, she had to hold his hand while he had a towel over him and just consumed scotches the whole way, because he hates flying that much. He also hated cruise ships, and they went on their honeymoon on a cruise ship, and it was one that got stuck and just kept going in a circle, so I had to get rescued.
Wow.
Yeah. That is, yeah, that sounds
on horrible. That note, Scott Sossel, thank you for joining us. Thank you.